and I knew the effects Sandman had. The nightmares. Toys had a lot of skeletons in his closet, and most likely he was going to meet every single one of them. As I had, when I'd been darted by the earlier generation known as Horsey. The original developer, Dr. William Hu, always claimed that shooting me had been an accident, a pistol malfunction. Bullshit, of course. Hu was gone now, a victim of one of Harcourt Bolton's master plans. One of many, many victims of the man behind the Kuga mask. I settled back and waited for the jet to begin rolling. Before we even got up to ground speed, Ghost was chewing on a piece of jerky. Chapter 83. Rotterdam, The Hague, Airport, South Holland, The Netherlands. Stafford stood and listened to the massive silence on the other end of the cell call. He did not dare break it or ask if the man on the other end of the line was still there. Finally, Kuga spoke. His voice was much calmer than Stafford had expected. "You earned a lot of brownie points with the Java thing," said Kuga. "You banked a lot of goodwill currency, but I have to tell you, son, you're burning through it pretty fast. You let Ledger slip away? Jesus H. Christ, Esquire!" Stafford said nothing. Apologies were useless and even dangerous with Kuga. Ditto for Santoro, who was probably listening in. "Where is he going?"
"Best guess, Berlin."
"Why?" asked Kuga. "Again?"
"Just a guess, but Casanova."
Another silence. "Shit. How soon?"
"Not sure," said Stafford. "If he's going after the processing plant, there are only two ways to get in. Either he needs to get Church to work some kind of magic to get permissions, or he's got to try to break in.
Alone, that's impossible."
"Maybe we should stop trying to decide what's impossible for this son of a bitch, much as it actually hurts to say it, boss. He's impressing the hell out of me."
"Hooray," Kuga said icily. "So, sure, we don't underestimate Ledger. Lesson learned. What are you going to do about it?"
"First, I need to catch him. And if I wait for the next commercial flight with an available seat, I'll be here for 7 hours. Even with Ledger needing to find the right equipment for a break-in, he'll be ahead of me."
"No," said Kuga. "That's not soon enough. He'll slip your punch. Again."
There was a pause.
"Let me make a call, stay at the airport, and be ready."
The line went dead.
Chapter 84. The Playroom, undisclosed location near Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Rafael Santoro looked up from his desk as Eve limped into the room. She was dressed in regular clothes, no camo, no low-slung gun belt.
"Eve," he said, smiling. "Thank you for coming so quickly."
"Anything for you, Daddy,"
said the woman as she made her way across the expensive Turkish rug. Santoro watched her eyes, looking for the flicker of pain with each step. He wondered how much of that pain was physical and how much was emotional. Maybe a 20-80 split, he judged. The part of him who was exactly who he was enjoyed that 80%. The part that was the mentor and only surviving friend of the woman felt true empathy for the remaining percentage. It was an interesting mix, and one nearly unique in his personal experience.
"Have a seat, my dear," he said, waving her to one of the two richly upholstered leather guest chairs opposite the desk.
"Coffee? No?
Tell me how you are feeling today."
"You know how I'm feeling,"
she said bluntly.
"Hurt, angry, and anxious to put Joe Ledger's head on a pike?" he suggested.
"Yeah, sure, but not in that order."
"And the knee?"
She shrugged. A total knee replacement had been performed a month ago, but there had been some complications, and the doctors were trying to decide if they needed to go back in. The poor function of the new knee required that she go back to wearing the knee brace. They sat with that for a moment while hidden speakers played the opera Atlantida, a cantata escenica based on a Catalan poem by Jacint Verdaguer. It was moody and superb. 2 full minutes of it played before Eve spoke again.
Knee or no knee, I'm telling you right now, Daddy, that if I don't get out there and do something, I'm going to go totally apeshit.
Santora nodded. I understand, my sweet, but we cannot act rashly.
Is that some kind of dig? Because of what happened at the pavilion?
He smiled and shook his head.
My angel, what does it matter to me if you vented some of your pressure by indulging your appetites?
HK fucking freaked. Hers is a more orderly mind. More sane, you mean?
Said Eve, cutting him a suspicious glance.
No. Are any of us truly sane? We could not be who we are if we were that mundane. No, my daughter, you are allowed to play.
She started to speak, but he stopped her with a raised finger.
As long as you do not include the righteous and the elites in your fun and games, yes?
She said nothing.
Please show me the respect of an answer, Eve, he said, and there was that subtle edge. He never clubbed her, but he did make small cuts.
Yes, Daddy.
There's my angel, he said, smiling warmly.
Then he changed the subject.
HK has kept me up to date with the training, and our development team has assured me that the equipment we have is more than adequate to our needs.
Even with Joe fucking Ledger cutting throats all over the place? Seems to me that he's on to us.
And what if he is?
Asked Santoro, raising his eyebrows.
Isn't the shit he's done going to derail us?
Oh, no, Eve. It's far too late for his shenanigans to stop what's coming. At best, he'll find us just in time for your righteous to tear him apart. Tell me, do you know what it means to draw and quarter someone?
Sure,
she brightened.
Oh, sweet, I can have 4 of my guys do that.
Yes, he said. You can and you should. So, if he is on his way, then let him come.
He'll bring that whole goon squad with him.
I dearly hope he does, said Santoro. Even with whatever information Ledger has managed to steal or coerce from our various laboratories, he will never be able to stop what's about to happen.
He leaned forward.
America will burn, my daughter.
Eve got to her feet, leaned across the desk, took Santoro by the face with both hands, and pulled him to her for a kiss. Not a sexual one, he was her father, after all, but it was full of a certain kind of passion. And Rafael Santoro, who loved his daughter more than anything left alive on earth, allowed it. Then he pushed her gently back.
Now listen to me, he said softly. I have a special mission for you.
She grinned.
Berlin?
Yes, he said. Berlin.
Chapter 85. Rotterdam Marriott Hotel, Rotterdam, the Netherlands. Toys woke up with a groan. Sickness washed through him, and he crawled across the floor and into the bathroom, then threw up the excellent food and wine. It took monumental effort to turn on the shower, strip off his clothes, and collapse into the bottom of the stall. The water pounded on him. He hadn't gotten the water mix right, and the blast was icy.
You bastard!
He gasped. The Sandman had conjured inescapable nightmares for Toys, and his worst dreams were always about the innocent people he'd killed before Church had lured him away from that life. Toys had long ago memorized each name, knew details of their lives. They haunted him at the best of times, but in the drug-induced nightmares, they tore him apart endlessly. Later. Much later. He took a proper shower, though his legs were still shaky. Then he ordered more food, and when it arrived, sat staring at it, as if it were a plate of steaming offal. It wasn't until he staggered back from his fourth bathroom trip that he saw the briefcase. It was on a chair across the suite. It was a very expensive case. A Webster X Charles Simon Graphite Mackenzie aluminum one. The same kind Sebastian Galt used. Very durable, hard to open. Stylish, which Toys took to mean that Ledger had stolen it. The barbarian had no personal style. The case was unlocked. He opened it to find file folders crammed with data stolen from the people Ledger had killed, and several external hard drives. On top of those, though, was a handwritten note. "Don't come looking for me again. Next time I'll use a different gun." Toys took the case over to the bed and rifled through the contents.
"Jesus Christ," he murmured, and scrambled to find his cell phone.
However, before he could even dial a call, there was a knock on the door. He frowned, fetched his pistol, and peered out through the peephole, and grunted in surprise. Two people stood in the hall, a short, dumpy young man who looked like Matt Damon if the actor broke training, lost IQ points, and forgot how to dress, and a tall, fit, elegant, and very beautiful woman with dark hair and darker eyes. Toys ran fingers through his hair, tucked the gun into his waistband, and opened the door. The woman gave him a slow up-and-down appraisal.
"Toys," said Violin, "you look awful."
"Yeah, man," said Harry Bolt. "You really look like shit." Toys stepped back to let them in.
"Well, you can both kiss my ass, but come on in anyway. Did church send you?"
"No,"
said Violin as she breezed past.
"My mother did."
"Looking for Ledger, I assume," he said, closing the door behind them. "Well, you just missed that rotten son of a bitch. He's probably out of the effing country by now."
"Yes," said Violin. "And he's on his way to Germany. Get dressed and packed. I have a plane waiting for us at the airport."
"What?"
"Arclight has had people looking for Joe ever since he went gonzo," said Harry. He was a former CIA agent, and according to everyone who ever worked with him, a truly awful one. He'd only gotten fast-tracked through the academy and into the field because of who his father was. If Harry was the worst, then his father, Harcourt Bolton Sr., was arguably the best the agency ever had. The irony was that the senior Bolton, the most decorated agent in the company's history, had also been the worst traitor. While Harry, however inept at tradecraft, had proved himself to have unbreakable integrity. Violin had taken him under her wing and was teaching him, a task that proved to everyone who knew them both that she had the patience of a living saint. Toys nodded.
"Have a seat. There's still some wine left, and beer, though it's lukewarm by now."
"Works for me," said Harry, taking a bottle. He offered it to Violin, who shook her head, so he twisted off the top and took a long drink.
"What happened here?"
asked Violin. Toys glared at her.
"Ledger is a shit-eating asshole."
Harry snorted beer through his nose.
"Tell me about it while you pack," said Violin,
settling back in a chair. Chapter 86. In flight over German airspace. It wasn't a very long flight from Rotterdam to Berlin, but it still gave me time to think. I felt like a bit of a shit for what I'd done to Toys. The more I thought about it, the more I regretted it. And of course, once he told Junie what I'd done, that would likely be the last damned straw. Was I trying to drive her away? The darkness whispered one answer to me. The other voices, the modern man, the killer, and the cop, whispered another, but each answer was another shade of yes. Ghost had his head in my lap and was benefiting from my jangling nerves by getting even more pets and treats than usual. Dog therapy. It's a thing. The feel of his soft fur and the awareness of his unconditional love were an anchor. Possibly the only clean tether I had left. The only other thing holding me to the desire to remain alive was the fact that Santoro was still sucking air. But what was going to happen if I caught and killed him? Where and who would I be then? At one point I got up and went into the toilet, locked the door, and stood for a long time looking into my eyes. I'd come out of the total control of the darkness. I thought. I hoped. But I still had so many questions. What was the darkness? I mean, exactly. Had my cracked mind completely fractured? Could it ever be put back together again? At times, during brief moments of terrified lucidity, I wondered if this was more of Kuga's mind games. During the Killswitch case, he used the God Machine to actually invade my mind. Tops and bunnies, too. He'd forced them to commit murders. Was that happening all over again? I almost hoped it was, though even my wishful thinking couldn't help me construct a scaffold of probability for that because I was doing damage to Kuga. If not that, then what? I even flirted with the possibility that this was demonic possession. I didn't actually believe in demons, but there was a bright and silvery thread of hope in that. A chance for this all not to be my fault. If it was neither of those things, then what was I left with? Me. Damaged. Broken beyond repair. And no, I didn't think that just because I felt it was my hands currently on the steering wheel that it was over, nor did I try to lie to myself that what I did, however extreme, was for the good of all. That it was the right thing to do. I'd tried that rationalization on back in Italy, but it fit no better then than it did now. So where did that leave me? Who was I now? What was I now? And was there any real way to ever go home again? Because I could not stop for death. Part 5. The murdered do haunt their murderers, I believe. I know that ghosts have wandered on earth. Be with me always, take any form, drive me mad, only do not leave me in this abyss where I cannot find you. Emily Bronte. One need not be a chamber to be haunted. Emily Dickinson. Chapter 87. Das Verarbeitungszentrum, Wannsee, Borough of Steglitz-Zehlendorf, Berlin, Germany. The place did not exist. Not officially. That's what I was told. That's what I read in RTI reports. Not in any computer record or database. It was never mentioned by name in any email or data file sharing. The few people in Germany, England, and the United States who knew about it also knew better than to make any references in any traceable way. Spies were everywhere, in cyberspace and the real world. Someone was always watching or listening. When the place had to be referred to, even obliquely, it was given the bland nickname of Das Verarbeitungszentrum, the processing center. There were thousands of places in Germany that processed something, sales, deliveries, Amazon fulfillment, insurance claims. It was the kind of name that never rang a bell or raised a red flag. Only 8 key people within those 3 governments knew that the processing center was a prison, which made it the ultimate black site. Prisoners who went there might as well have slipped through a hole in the dimension. They were simply gone. The staff knew, of course, but they were sequestered in 6-month shifts without Wi-Fi or internet. No email, no cell phones, no contact at all with the outside world. Only unmarried soldiers were assigned to the facility, and they were deeply screened beforehand and carefully debriefed afterward. Those employees each signed a non-disclosure document that erased all their rights should they break their oath. A single fracture in the chain of confidentiality would result in arrest, the ruin of their families and their futures, and very possibly incarceration in one of the cells within that forbidding place. Yeah, we live in fun times. From the outside, it looked like the fiction its designers were selling. A slab-sided block building with few windows, loading bays for trucks, and a security fence that looked absurdly non-threatening. What passers-by could not see were the motion sensors, camouflaged high-def cameras, satellite surveillance, and frequent flyovers by drones designed to look exactly like common hooded crows. And although the fence was not electrified, there were panels on all the surrounding interior grounds and walkways that were. The default setting was approximately that of a moderate taser, but during a crisis, they could be dialed up to give a lethal jolt of 200 milliamps. That'll curl the hairs on your nuts effectively. Those pads were weight-sensitive so as not to fry birds, cats, or raccoons. The windows were false. Each was a rear screen projection of long loops of footage of real office buildings taken elsewhere. Behind those screens were steel panels. The doors opened with simple key cards, but once inside, there were massive security doors requiring several types of scans: retina, thumbprint, exhaled breath, and spoken day codes. Breaching the walls would require a hell of a lot of explosives, and those walls and every door were wired by alarms that rang audibly or quietly, but in the right places, to send a lot of grouchy German soldiers with guns. The plan had been direct and effective: to make Das Verarbeitungszentrum fade into the background of a sleepy tourist suburb of a major city, and to be essentially impregnable. "No one can find it," the designers assured the three governments that shared the invisible prison. "No one can beat it." Chapter 88. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece.
"Boss!" Bug shouted, leaning his head out of his office and yelling loudly enough to make everyone jump. "I got him!"
Church, who had been in deep conversation with Scott Wilson, wheeled around.
"Where?"
"Germany."
"Germany?" exclaimed Wilson. "That isn't on our list of possible targets for him, are you sure?"
"Pretty darn sure," Bug waved Church and Wilson into his office. Outside, at least 30 staff members had already clustered, craning their necks, jostling one another for a view.
"Someone hit our safe house on Krampenberger Straße in Berlin," he said. "Darted the poor guy stationed there. Guy woke up a few minutes ago and says last thing he remembered was watching a rerun of a cop show, something called Alarm for Cobra something something."
"Alarm for Cobra 11, die Autobahnpolizei," translated Wilson. "Highway police show that's been on forever."
"Yeah, so that rerun started at 2 o'clock p.m. local time."
Church looked at his watch. "That's 9 hours and change." He glanced at Bug. "What did he take?"
"A full field kit, including a mind reader substation and tactical computer, bunch of drones, weapons, clothes, you name it. And the officer there thinks maybe an old trade winds kite."
"For what possible purpose?" asked Wilson.
Church ignored that and instead said,
"The substation has a tracker."
"Oh, already on it. Looks like Joe's in the suburbs. Here, let me pull it up."
Bug loaded the tracking software, which immediately brought up a map. He pulled in on the screen, which brought up an overlay with town and street names.
"Wannsee," read Wilson. "In the borough of Steglitz-Zehlendorf. Why is he—"
Then he stiffened so quickly it looked like he was snapping to attention. He turned to Church.
"No. Surely not."
"I think he is,"
said Church, and there was the faintest hint of an admiring smile on his lips.
"Is what?" asked Bug.
"He's going to try and break into Das Verarbeitungszentrum," said Wilson, "which of course is impossible."
Chapter 89. Das Verarbeitungszentrum, Wannsee, Borough of Steglitz-Zehlendorf, Berlin, Germany.
"So, I broke into the processing plant. Took about 3 minutes. Even brought Ghost, and he loves this kind of thing, going where we're not supposed to go, pissing on someone else's floor. I could have gotten actual permission to enter the facility, but there were three good reasons why I didn't. First, it would take too much time. The world runs on red tape, and I hate bureaucracy with the fiery intensity of 1,000 suns. I'm stealing that quote, though I neither know nor care who from. The second reason is that going through channels would likely result in me being accompanied by agents of barrier,
the UK's most covert black operations outfit, some CIA spooks, and a team of busybodies from Germany's own off-the-record group of black ops shooters, Der Leuchtturm. I wasn't really in the mood for a party. Ghost was all the company I needed, and he was never all that chatty, and let's face it, with Toys reporting back about me shooting him, and Church evaluating all the intel on my actions, crimes, hard to pick the right word, he'd likely make the calls to ensure that I'd be met by a platoon armed with Sandman darts and a big butterfly net. No thanks. And third, a very bad man told me, reluctantly, I might add, that a very highly placed member of the Kuga organization was incarcerated there. Not entirely sure if it was the darkness or me who asked those questions. My mind is still clogged with mud. For now, I suppose it's enough to remember the answers we got. The prisoner was a Catalonian named Casanova. Actual name. Born Diego Casanova, but later dropped the given name. Maybe he thought that would get him laid more often, but from the surveillance photos I acquired, he was no charmer. Looked like Steve Buscemi, if someone had hit Steve in the face repeatedly with a 1x3. And he was a brute. 6'3", 320, with the shoulders and arms of a mountain gorilla. A guy like that wasn't getting laid unless he was paying for it, and even then, he could send even a hardened prostitute straight to therapy. Casanova worked for Kuga. He worked with Rafael Santoro, which meant that his ass was worth only what value I was willing to put on it. A chatty Casanova who could nudge me a step closer to getting my fingers around Santoro's throat was likely to live long enough to see how good his retirement plan was. A reticent Casanova was going to have a very, very bad night. What really sucked for Casanova was that he was the one person who might finally put me on the path to finding Santoro and Kuga, and by find, I mean tear to pieces so I could piss on their corpses. I didn't need the darkness to want to do that, or to give me some kind of spiritual or existential permission. And the fact that Casanova was in one of the counter-terrorist community's secretest and most impregnable black site prisons did not worry me all that much. Actually, it amused me in a weird kind of way. Lately, a lot of very strange things amused me. I should probably get that looked at. Rudy Sanchez would likely have a lot to say on the subject, but at the moment I wasn't much in the mood for analysis, a sermon, or a lecture. I wasn't taking his calls or anyone else's. This was a solo gig. Except for the big white fur monster, of course. I didn't have my own team with me either. Havoc Team was composed of the best when it came to Tier 1 Spec Ops shooters, and when things were going south, they could get real mean and damned ugly, but they wouldn't approve of what I was doing. Well, not the way I was doing it. Not even a little. So, that left Ghost and me. To bypass the fence, I used a Tradewinds motor kite. It was an older one, and the motor was on its last gasp, but I didn't need it to do much. Best it could manage was 20 feet of lift and 70 yards of distance. We sailed over the fence as the lurid red sunset was fading to a muddy and indistinct purple-black. The kite soared over the fence, silent as a shadow, and approached the building from one corner. I had a jammer clipped to my belt that would futz with the motion sensors and cameras for the duration of our flight, and the Google Scout glasses I wore helped me avoid the heat signatures from the high-voltage paving stones. I'd stopped by an RTI safehouse and took as many goodies as I could. The agent on duty was sleeping off a Sandman dart, and I seriously doubted I'd be getting a Christmas card from him. Ghost hung from my chest in a Mylar sling, his legs and tail dangling, tongue lolling as if this was fun. The dog's a bit weird. He also likes skydiving, which I really do not. There were two pairs of security guards on routine patrol, but I'd waited until they were heading around to the far side. It took them approximately 6 minutes for a circuit of the building, working in different directions. I touched down just as they were each turning opposite corners, walking the kite to the wall as I hit the button to collapse the wings and released Ghost's sling. He immediately turned and watched my back, hunkering low, eyes moving over the landscape. The whole kite rig collapsed down to the size of a folded beach umbrella, and I quickly stowed it behind a line of manicured hedges. I was dressed all in black, with a balaclava that hid my face, with thin but very tough limb pads and body armor. It was a brand of Kevlar and spider silk around layers of D-30, a gooey substance that in its raw state flows like syrup, but when struck, locks together, absorbs and disperses energy as heat before returning to its semi-fluid state. The body armor can stop most bullets, even 223, 5.56, and 7.62 by 39 rifle slugs. And the spider silk polymer blends can turn a knife, which Kevlar alone can't do. I also wore the latest generation of shock-reducing ballistic helmet. Sensors sewn into the fabric of my clothes sent real-time data to one screen of my glasses. Raiding the RTI safehouse was a bad risk, but the gear was necessary, and it felt oddly comforting to be back in an official combat rig. Though, yes, that also conjured guilt for what I'd done to my friends over the last month. Inside my head, the darkness laughed as if saying that I would never live long enough for those kinds of regrets to matter. Ghost whimpered as if he could sense or even hear those thoughts. The door I wanted was a bland metal variety set into the wall 18 feet from where we'd touched down. As I reached it, I removed two small devices. The first was the size of a postage stamp and painted a neutral gray, with a clear plastic strip on the back. I peeled that off to expose photosensitive chemicals and then pressed it to the side of the metal door for 3 seconds. When I finished counting Mississippis, I pulled the strip off and saw that it was now the same color as the door. I turned it over and removed the tape from the other side, exposing a strong adhesive, and then pressed it to the door at about knee level, below where the eye would not naturally fall. Unless you knew exactly where to look, the thing was invisible, blending in completely with the paint. The little chameleon bug had incredible pickup and could relay info up to a quarter mile. Next, I took a gizmo about the size of a nickel, removed the adhesive backing, then placed it on the underside of the keycard box that was mounted to the right of the door. I then took one of our blank magnetic keycards and went through the process of having Mind Reader load it with the proper codes. Of course, I knew that using that Q1 tactical computer meant that what I was doing would be sent to Bug. He would tell Church I was in Berlin and where in Berlin I was. Ah, well, couldn't be helped. Made me wonder how quickly the big man would send someone to intercept me. I doubted it would be Toys. Who did that leave? Perhaps Violin? Or my old buddy Oscar Freund? Whoever it was inevitable someone would come and I needed to finish and get the hell out before they arrived. I pulled the door open and Ghost followed me inside. Then I eased the door shut, and the lock clicked comfortingly, as if nothing at all had just happened. Total elapsed time from lifting off with the motor kite to hearing that click was 3 minutes. Impregnable my ass.
Chapter 90. Berlin-Brandenburg Airport, Berlin, Germany. Michael Augustus Stafford ran down the steps of the private jet Kuga had loaned him for his mission. After the fiasco in Rotterdam, Stafford had appealed to him for better logistical support. The jet, a 2006 Gulfstream G150, which was the closest one available, was comfortable and fast, and Kuga's logistics team stepped up and convincingly fudged diplomatic clearances. It amused Stafford that he was flying as a representative of the World Health Organization on the hunt for a new COVID mutation. Everyone tripped over themselves, smoothing the way for him. There was a car waiting for him with a driver who knew the area exceptionally well.
"Vertusa,"
was the only thing the driver said. Stafford told him, and the car, a roomy and luxurious BMW X5, set off. That driver also provided a box of goodies for him, and while they tore along the darkened streets, Stafford outfitted himself with knives, guns, explosives, and electronics.
"I'm coming for you," muttered Stafford,
The driver on the other side of a closed glass partition heard nothing. I'm going to skin you alive, you prick. Chapter 91. Berlin-Brandenburg Airport, Berlin, Germany. The sleek, black Dassault Falcon 8X luxury jet touched down 14 minutes after Stafford's wheels hit the tarmac. The clearances had all been arranged by Annie Han, the computer hacker who officially worked for the South Korean government, but who owed her truest allegiance to ArcLight. The jet had a capacity for 16 passengers, but there were only three aboard, two men and a woman. They were met at customs by Oskar Freund, who had the papers and the authority to smooth their way through customs. A woman in driver's livery stood waiting at the curb.
He was spotted when he came out, she told them. We have a bird in the air.
The bird was a medium-range radar-deflecting surveillance drone originally designed for the Russian military. Plans and prototypes were stolen by an ArcLight hit team. The designer, his staff, and eight soldiers were killed in that raid, and one of Annie's tapeworms was introduced to the computers and internet to hunt down and completely erase all traces of that line of research. It was later learned that Putin's security officers placed the blame on a traitor within their own ranks. He denied it, of course, all the way up to the moment when a bullet punched through his brain. That he was innocent of that particular bit of internal espionage was outweighed by actual crimes for which lives had been lost. Annie and Lilith had no sympathies, not a shred.
Where is he now? Asked Violin.
Heading out of town, it appears, said the driver.
Catch him, said Toys, as he, Violin, and Harry Bolt climbed into the car. Ma'am? The driver asked Violin, and she nodded. Catch him as fast as possible.
The car peeled away from the curb, but before it could go half a kilometer, Violin's cell rang. The caller ID was a steeple.
Hello?
She said warmly. Are you on the ground yet? Asked Church.
Yes, we are following Stafford.
Change of plans, said Church. We know where Outlaw is going, and there's every chance he's going to need backup. Chapter 92. Das Verarbeitungszentrum, Wannsee Borough of Steglitz-Zehlendorf, Berlin, Germany. I tapped my scout glasses to switch from outside sensors to a floor plan of the processing plant. It was a big oblong building that was laid out for prisoner isolation rather than the standard prison cell block structure. Lots of small hallways leading to dead ends and offices, crew quarters, the mess hall, ops center, and other key areas used as buffers between the cells. The idea was to prevent prisoners from ever making contact with one another. Even the walls were baffled to suppress screams and yells, all of which was fine for me, since I neither wanted to be seen nor heard. I removed two different kinds of tiny drones made to look like bees. They had unfortunate nicknames hung on them by Doc Holliday. Busy bees and killer bees. The busy bees were designed to extend mind readers' scanning range in order to hack internal surveillance, and they had good cameras and mics. I activated 24 of them and tossed the whole bunch into the air. Their wings began buzzing, and off they went, flying fast down the corridors, staying high near the ceiling. While I waited for their feeds to reach my Q1 screen, I tapped some keys to let the supercomputer's intrusion software hack into the central security systems. That took about 11 seconds, and then I owned the place. I set all the hallway cameras to record video loops that were keyed to sensors in my clothing. As soon as I approached the operational range of the cameras, the pre-recorded loop would kick in, which meant I'd never appear on the monitors in the security office. Stealthy is my middle name. The same sensors were on Ghost's harness in case I had to send him wandering off without me. I knelt and gave Ghost a few short commands, one of which was Pax, Latin for peace. It meant that for the duration of the mission, and unless told otherwise, he was not to kill anyone. The staff here were not our enemies. If any of them got hurt during this invasion, then it was on me. I was okay with breaking and entering, but I wasn't looking to spill innocent blood. Ghost was a very smart and very well-trained combat dog, and he would follow my orders. While I waited, I deployed the other kind of drones, the Killer Bees. These were a bit larger and fitted with tiny dart shooters filled with Sandman. I'd have gone with Murder Hornets as the name for them, but I don't hold the patent. The feed from the Busy Bee drones came in and told me that there were 9 security personnel actively walking the halls, 3 on duty in the monitoring office, 5 more in a lounge watching a DVD of the latest Marvel movie, and 10 sleeping in a pair of bunkhouses. It was a large staff. The bees also confirmed that there were 39 inmates in the various cells scattered throughout the building. None of the prisoners were named in the computer records. That was fine. My informant said that Casanova was in cell number 13. I thought that was funny. Unlucky 13. I clicked through the various feeds to put eyes onto the facility staff and get a sense of them. Then I froze when I saw a group of people standing in one of the remotest hallways. There was an older man, tall, blonde, square-jawed, wearing an excellent suit. Beside him was a slightly shorter man with darker hair who held the hand of a very pretty woman. 2 kids stood in front of them, and the woman had a small but noticeable baby bump. A big puppy with a goofy grin sat between the kids. They looked directly up at the swarm of drones, as if they could somehow look through the bees to see me. I knelt there, staring at the faces. Even though the screen was tiny, I could somehow see them all with incredible clarity and detail. To the small scars on the arms of the woman, to the stitches on the baseball the little boy was throwing up into the air and catching in a worn leather glove, every single detail. It froze me. No, that's not right. When you freeze, it's like all the heat dies in the universe, all the way down to the atoms in your molecules. This wasn't that. This was hotter. I could feel actual heat, as if I crouched next to something burning, like a house, like bodies, like hope. I squeezed my eyes shut and sagged against the wall. Please, I begged. Please, please, please. I did not open my eyes until the heat dwindled, and faded completely. Even then I couldn't move. My heart was racing and shivers ran down my arms and spine. I was in a deep hole and there was no rope to use so I could climb out. There was only a little light, but it was fading. No, that wasn't right either. It was not that the light was growing weaker, but that the dark shadows all around me were getting stronger, overwhelming the light, dominating it, consuming it. There was so little of that light left that I knew it couldn't last. The darkness was winning. Please, I said again, but in that moment I couldn't tell if I was begging for mercy, for the light to flare, or for the darkness to come and take me body and soul. Then I felt pressure against my elbow and only then dared open my eyes to see Ghost nuzzling me, his doggy eyes filled with concern. My mouth was dry and my eyes were wet. I had no exposed skin for Ghost to lick, so he kept pushing at me with his nose. I reached for him with arms that weighed 10,000 pounds. I pulled my dog to me and wrapped my arms around him and clung to him. The screen on my computer showed an empty stretch of hall, no one there. Of course there was no one there. Tears burned behind my eyes. Ghost pushed his whole body against me, whining so softly only I could hear him, trying to tell me that he understood, that he was there for me, that I wasn't alone. It's okay, boy, I said. It's all okay. I'm okay. Ghost never cared that I told those kinds of lies. I did not want to let him go, but I had to. The clock in my head was ticking, and we were deep in the Badlands here. Ghost backed away a pace, but stayed close as I struggled to get my shit together. It was getting harder and harder to do that. This was not the first time I'd seen ghosts. I just hoped moments like this didn't get worse because I was already close to the edge. I'd been fooling myself that because the darkness was not in total control, it meant I was coming out of it, that I was edging back toward being sane. God damn! Chapter 93. Das Verarbeitungszentrum Wannsee, Borough of Steglitz-Zehlendorf, Berlin, Germany. I came back to myself, but there was effort in that process. General or abstract thinking won't get that done, so I forced myself to think about specific mission details. It helped, but I found myself not wanting to look at the screen on my tactical computer. I ground my teeth and looked anyway. I checked the signal from the busy bees again, but all they showed were more empty halls except where there were bored guards on patrol. Lots of locked doors. Only that. Only that. Unclench, I growled under my breath. Get your screwed up head out of your ass, Ledger. At any given time, I have three distinct personalities vying for control. The modern man is the idealistic optimist who is probably the person I would have become had it not been for a traumatic incident when I was a teenager. My girlfriend Helen and I had been jumped by a group of older teens. They beat me nearly to death and gang-raped Helen. Although we both technically survived that attack, we were never the same. I became psychologically fractured, retreating from who I truly was into a series of jagged glass pieces of other personalities. Therapists helped me clean house, but three remained, of which the modern man was the purest. Then there was his polar opposite, the killer, ruthless and violent, but always directing his rage at the people who did the kinds of things that had been done to Helen and me. In defense of the innocents, he will do things I never tell my friends or Junie Flynn. It was the killer, as much as any part of me, who'd kicked in Helen's door when she'd not answered her phone in days. It was he who'd gathered her cold body into his arms and howled like some demented thing. And it was he who'd steered me first toward the army, then the cops, and then my wet work as a shooter, first for the Department of Military Sciences and more recently for Rogue Team International. He knew there was a war to wage and was constantly ready to take it to the bad guys under a black flag. Well, let's call it a different kind of black flag. The killer never hurts the innocent. Ever. Most of the time, though, I was the cop. Reasonable, informed, precise, thorough, and pragmatic. A solver of problems, a logician, and strategist. The cop was the sense of order in my otherwise chaotic head. I was trying to get into the cop headspace now. Like my other aspects, he'd been shoved to the back by the darkness, so much so that he seemed to stop being anything but a memory. Now, I really needed him, desperately, to solve this, to make sense of this crazy hunt I was on, to pick up the pieces of my fragmented memory and puzzle them into some shape that had order and purpose. As random and obscure as the darkness was, there was a method in there, a plan, and I was sure that at the end of the chain of logic, no, I won't call it dark logic because that sounds too much like I'm playing Dungeons and Dragons with myself. Only this logic was skewed, slanted. It was like trying to understand a word puzzle in a different language. It had a different kind of emotional logic from the one I understood. I was fighting for understanding and fighting for control, and it was anyone's guess as to whether I was gaining ground or being fed crumbs by this new, dangerous, warped, and ugly aspect of myself. Funny, but when I was first aware of it, I'd told Rudy, and he was the one who gave it the name,
He called it the darkness, but for him, it was lowercase, not a proper noun. I knew differently. It was every bit as real a person within me as the modern man, the cop, and the killer. It wanted to live, just as they did. It wanted control, because just like the others, it had work to do. Unlike them, it did not want to share its secrets, its methods, or its toys. Earlier this year, after I got out of the hospital, I'd speculated about what a person does when they turn out all the lights. At first, I'd relied on the old military answer to that. You learn to use the darkness, but that was wrong. It was too commonplace an answer for a person as damaged as me. It wasn't that I learned to use the darkness imposed on me during that act of transgressive horror, no. In that moment, I became the darkness. Only I didn't know it yet. I think that by accepting that it was a real thing, I gave it license and access, neither of which I seemed able to take back. I didn't delude myself into thinking I was clear-headed now because I'd won any heroic internal struggle. Head in the fucking game, I told myself, and I realized I was so jangled I'd nearly said it too loudly. Even Ghost gave me a sharp, questioning look. Sorry, I told him, pitching my voice much lower. Ghost gave an eloquent grunt of reproof. The busy bees helped me map out the safest route, and so we set off. Ghost went first, and I relied on his nose and his instincts every bit as much as my electronic doodads. We moved silently along the dimly lit halls, pausing now and then to allow foot patrols to make a turn down a corridor before we entered that passage. Everything was so quiet. We were near the staff lounge, and I couldn't hear the explosions and dramatic music of superheroes and villains beating the snot out of one another. Nice. Made me want to send a box of chocolates to whomever designed the acoustics. Maybe give him a foot massage. One confusing thing was that the cells were so scattered that it was tough to follow the numbering system. Nor were there arrows on the walls or those colored lines you see in some factories to guide you to key points. Likely that was to make it even more difficult to find any specific person. That would have been frustrating if I didn't have a tactical version of the world's most sophisticated computer on my arm. It took me under 5 minutes to locate cell 13. It was snugged way back into a corner, with the adjoining rooms proving to be dry storage for office supplies on one side and the electrical room on the other. And that was lucky, too, because the machines in the electrical room generated a constant audible hum, further masking incidental sound. Luck seemed to be on my side. Ghost and I peered around a corner, saw the foot patrol making a left at the far T junction, and then we hurried to the cell. Some jokester on the staff had used a Sharpie to draw a big red heart on a sheet of printer paper and had taped that to the door for the great lover, Casanova. Cute. I knelt outside his room and spent a couple of minutes sending new protocols to my swarms. The busy bees fanned out and landed high on walls near the corners, positioned to watch for foot patrols coming my way. By resting on the walls, they conserved their batteries. As for the killer bees, I sent two to each intersection. If things got freaky, the busy bees could paint approaching guards with tiny lasers, and the killer bees would zero in on each specific guard and send them into slumberland. I didn't want to have to do that, but the way my luck's been running, I figured I'd have to. Once I was outside again, any bees I could not retrieve would be sent a detonation code that would activate minuscule thermite charges. There'd be nothing left for a forensic analysis and no way to trace it back to me or RTI. No way for Bug to track me either. I attached another of my doohickeys to the lock on the cell door, sicked Q1 on the security links, and then used the keycard cloning tool to bypass the lock. When all this was over, whoever designed this place as impregnable was going to need crisis counseling.
Then I looked at Ghost to see if he was ready. He was. His brown eyes were very cold and his muscles tensed for action. I opened the door and we stepped inside. Chapter 94. Das Verarbeitungszentrum, Cell 13. Casanova was reading a book. For some bizarre reason I will never know, it was a copy of A Wrinkle in Time. Seemed an improbable choice. He looked up at me, frowning at my weapons and gear. His frown turned to apprehension when he saw Ghost. Casanova picked up a torn piece of toilet paper, placed it to mark his page, set the book down, then looked at us with all the blank anticipation of a schoolboy ready for his lesson. I closed the door, sealing us in the soundproofed cell. When I needed to leave, all I had to do was approach the door and the Q1 interface would convince the locking mechanism that I'd swiped the key card again. The wonders of modern science. His eyes narrowed, then he glanced up at the video camera that was protected behind a tough wire screen. The little light was on, but he had no way of knowing the feed was on a continuous loop. "Morning, lover boy," I said brightly. I said it in Spanish. His native tongue was Catalan, but everyone in Catalonia also speaks Spanish. Besides, Catalan wasn't one of my languages. "What is this shit?" he asked, but without emphasis, the way a surly prisoner would, but not one who wanted to risk his privileges. "This shit," I explained, "is a private conversation. It will go like this. I'll ask questions, and you will give honest and very complete answers."
"Is that what you think will happen?"
He seemed amused.
"It is. You may not think so, but yeah, that's how it's going to play out," I said. "And in case you have doubts, there are penalties for wrong answers. But let me say right now that you really don't want to find out what they are."
I put some real edge into it, but whether I approximated the voice of the darkness, I will never know. The memories of those other interrogations give me some of the words, but none of the true flavor. Was that good or bad? No way to know. Casanova eyed me, taking inventory of the off-market body armor, the computer strapped to my arm, and my various weapons. A pair of Randall Mark 14 attack knives strapped upside down to my armored vest, a 6-hour 9mm in a shoulder rig, and a gun of a type he'd likely never seen before in my hand. That was a Snellig 22 AMAX gas dart gun, which is proprietary tech made exclusively for Rogue Team International. No one else has it. All Casanova knew was that the barrel of a nasty-looking pistol was pointing at his favorite crotch. He had a lot of reaction choices, but Casanova opted for nonchalance. He sat back, his shoulders resting against the cold concrete.
"You come in here with your dog, and what do you call that, some kind of ninja costume, all black and scary?"
He spat on the floor an inch from my shoe. Not a lot of sputum, but enough to make a statement.
"I will tell you what I told the last 10 interrogators."
"Oh," I said, "and what was that?"
"I told them to go fuck their mothers up their asses," he said calmly, "and to not bother with lubricant. Really, you should do the same. It's how your mother likes me to fuck her."
He grinned. Casanova had large horse teeth, and one of the front ones was gray, evidence of a dead nerve.
"Here's the thing, buttercup," I said. "That's usually a good line if you want to start a fight. And you're a pretty big lump of shit, so maybe you've made somebody piss his pants once upon a time. Maybe you've pushed buttons that made other people lose their cool and swing on you, which is a nice way of canceling an interrogation, blah, blah, blah. Sad truth is, you don't have the gravitas or the cool to sell that line to someone who's actually in the game." He got slowly to his feet and did his level best to loom.
"Fuck you and your mother."
Ghost stepped forward and gave a menacing growl, but I clicked my tongue and he immediately sat down. Ears up, tail flat, eyes merciless.
I'm not afraid of you or that fucking dog, he said.
Statements like that speak poorly of your ability to read the room, I said. There must have been some quality in my voice because I saw a flicker on his face. He looked me up and down, head cocked to one side, as if trying to remember where he might have heard my voice before.
Who are you?
He asked. I took off my helmet, removed my goggles, and pulled off the black balaclava I wore beneath, and then I let him take a good long look at my face. I didn't have to say my name, and I could see the exact moment when he recognized me. His eyes slowly widened, and his lips parted to say a single word.
No,
he breathed. I said, yes. Chapter 95. Das Wehrarbeitungszentrum, Security Office. Corporal Heinz Kepler looked up from the duty sheet he'd been filling out and stared at one of the 28 video screens on the wall over his desk. Most screens showed nighttime stillness. A few showed guards patrolling the halls. However, there was movement in one of the exterior screens, the one covering the front gate. A big, white Mercedes Vario was idling on the turnaround. It was similar to the supply trucks used to deliver supplies to the processing plant, but no deliveries were expected, and certainly not at this hour. Kepler tapped his shift partner on the shoulder.
Hey, Gunnar, look at this.
Gunnar, who had been reading a copy of Der Spiegel, looked up over his reading glasses. He grunted.
Lost, he said. Maybe looking for directions.
The driver's door opened and a slim woman slid down to the ground. She had a blonde ponytail sticking out of the back of a blue-billed cap and wore a blue windbreaker, tight jeans, and a black leg brace around her left knee. She walked up to the fence and stared directly into the camera. The blonde blew a kiss to whomever was watching, then turned and walked toward the back of the truck.
What the hell?
Murmured Kepler. They leaned forward to study the video.
Gruner touched the screen. Hey, what's that? Who's that with her?
Chapter 96. Das Wehrarbeitungszentrum, Cell 13. Casanova knew he was in trouble. All the pieces clicked. I'd come in wearing non-regulation clothes and equipment and had not brought the usual kind of backup. No other guards with shock rods or tasers. This was clearly off the books. That, and he recognized me. He knew he was in a very small room with Joe Ledger and a nasty dog. He was bigger and heavier than I was, but he shrank away, backing up until he thumped into the wall, eyes clicking left and right as if magical doorways would suddenly appear. The door behind me was closed. The fact that the cell was soundproof was something he'd already know about. That left him in the exact center of Shit Creek, not a paddle in sight. So, he tried for it. He suddenly pushed off the wall and swung a punch at me that had every ounce of his massive body weight behind. If it had connected, he'd have broken my jaw at the very least, and possibly my neck. His fist was the size and hardness of a bocce ball. Then all he'd have to do was fight Ghost, who would not attack unless I ordered him to, or if he perceived I was losing a fight, and by then Casanova might have been able to take a gun from my body as I fell. If he'd connected. I saw the muscle flex of his waist as he began that push-off, his power turning to put torque into his attack. I saw it and walked right into the center of that turn and smashed my right forearm across his upper chest while chopping at his punching arm with my left elbow. His mass and momentum collided with my surge and precision. The physics were all wrong for him. He had momentum but no balance. He crashed back against the wall, grunting out a deep "huh" of breath. I pistol-whipped him with the Snelling and then swept the inside of one ankle with the arch of my shoe and as he dropped, I pounded down on both shoulders with the bottoms of one fist and the butt of the dart gun. Really damned hard. His ass hit the floor, and there was a muffled, wet crack that I knew was his tailbone breaking. His scream was incredibly shrill for such a big man. I stepped between his thighs and placed the sole of my boot on his scrotum. Not hard. Not yet. In a very quiet voice, I said, "Shut the fuck up." He did. Ghost was on his feet now, baring his teeth, ready to take a piece. I moved my foot and Casanova fell over onto his side, pulling his knees up to protect his balls and to take some pressure off the damage to his coccyx. He groaned and sobbed and started to say something else about my mother, but stopped himself, probably weighed the risk-reward thing and didn't like his odds. I didn't like those odds either, and no, not because he dissed my mom. She died years ago. Although if she'd been alive, she'd have fed him his own dick. Mom had always been a sweet lady, but only up to a point. Let's just say that someone calling me a mama's boy was something I'd take as a compliment. I sat on the edge of the bed. "Listen to me, asshole," I said quietly. "You're between a rock and a hard place. Rafael Santoro will kill you if you talk to me. So will Kuga. We both know that." He'd been squeezing his eyes shut, but he forced them open to look at me. He was sweaty, his skin was gray, and there were tears in his eyes. "Rafael Santoro murdered my family. All of them. Even an unborn baby." "No, no, don't close your eyes. Don't you dare look away. I want you to see my face. I want you to look into my eyes and listen to my voice and then decide if you are more afraid of those men who are hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles away, or me, the guy who is right here with you this very minute." I gave him a few moments on that. "By now you'll have heard about what I did in Italy, in Johannesburg, Krakow. I've been having some fun out there. Have you heard?" "Yeah, I can see it in your eyes," I said. "I guess you have someone feeding you information. Good." It took him a moment to find his voice.
"You're just going to kill me. Why should I tell you anything?"
I shrugged. "You only heard about Italy, Johannesburg, and Krakow, but you didn't hear about the other places I've been. Want to know why?" He said nothing, but he was as attentive as a schoolboy. "You didn't hear about the other places because I didn't leave blood on those walls," I said. "How do you think I found those other places, those other labs and warehouses, the other safe houses? I've had conversations like this quite a few times, sport. I've had meaningful chats with some people just like you. Or maybe they were smarter. Maybe they valued their own lives enough to answer my questions without trying the sucker punch crap. Don't get me wrong, though. Sometimes I had to ask in very specific ways. You think you're in pain now? Imagine how you'll feel if you fuck with me or stonewall me. I'm leaving here with information. That's one of life's few certainties. The question is whether I get all cranked and cut your balls off and feed them to my dog first, or whether I leave happy and you get medical treatment for a slip and fall. Your face isn't marked, so no one here will ever know we had this chat." His eyes were huge, but I could see him working it out. He glanced at the door, then at Ghost, and back up at me. There were beads of greasy sweat on Casanova's upper lip and forehead. Some of it was pain, and some was fear. Equal portions, I'd guess.
"How do I know You won't kill me?
He asked. You don't, I said. You have to roll the dice. Except that one thing you do know is that if you don't talk, you will die, and you'll die badly. Soundproofed walls, a hungry dog, and a motherfucker who doesn't give one little tiny roach turd about you. That's one of two outcomes. Take a moment and think about which option sounds more fun to you. I stopped talking and let him work on it. The clock in my head was telling me to speed it up. The guard I darted at the safe house was probably awake, pissed off, and making calls, which meant Bug knew and Church knew. Maybe someone was already on their way. I wondered, would Church send Toys after me again, or would it be Top and Bunny this time? Either way, someone would come. I could feel the darkness in my head wanting to reassert itself and do very awful things, even if Casanova gave me what I wanted. It was so damned hard to keep the lights on in my soul. Tick-tock, I prompted. His eyes were jumpy, as if he were a cornered rat and the sweat was running down his cheeks. I made a small and unobtrusive finger gesture, and Ghost immediately came over and sat close enough so that his hot breath blew against Casanova's face. Dog drool spattered the man's orange prison onesie.
Okay, he blurted. Okay, okay, okay.
Okay, what? I asked quietly.
Okay, I tell you what you want to know, goddamn your eyes.
What is it you think I want to know? I asked.
Look, he said, I don't actually know where Kuga is. I've heard rumors somewhere in Canada, somewhere in Texas. Who knows? I don't know. No one does. But I can tell you where you can find Rafael Santoro.
My heart was throwing haymaker punches against the walls of my chest. I pushed Ghost out of the way and leaned close so that it was my own furnace breath, my own hot spit he felt on his face.
Where is he?
It came out as three words, three beats. He flinched as if each one were a physical blow. Casanova looked absolutely terrified of me, of the dark things he saw in my eyes. He said,
if you want to find Santoro, you need to go talk to Dikatsi.
The Cat. A codename for a guy our friends at Barrier had been tracking. No one knew his real name, but he'd been a key lieutenant in the old Ohan International Black Market operation, though before that had worked in the sex trafficking business. A real evil son of a bitch, heartless and mercenary in the extreme. After Ohan got his throat cut, the Cat had become a free agent. I hadn't heard that he was tied in with Kuga, though it made sense.
That's only useful information if you can tell me where to find Dikatsi,
I said.
At the Hotel Timisoara,
blurted Casanova. Now that he was talking, he seemed to want to please me. Smart move, since his life depended on it. There is no actual honor among thieves. There's only fear. And he was more afraid of me at that moment than of anyone else.
You need to promise me that you'll kill Santoro if he ever suspects I told you.
Oh, bet your whole allowance on that, I promised. The big man studied me for a moment, then nodded.
Okay. Go to the Hotel Timisoara. Dikatsi will be there in 4 days. He's overseeing a sale on behalf of Mr. Sunday.
Who's that? Casanova licked his lips.
He's the head of sales for Kuga. I never met him and only ever saw him on Showroom.
He explained what Showroom was, and I wondered if Bug already knew about this. If not, I was going to have to break the silence and tell him. The further I moved away from dominance by the darkness, the more I realized that I needed the RTI infrastructure. What is Dikatsi selling?
I don't know exactly. Some kind of drug. Not for street use. It supposedly has military applications. You'll have to ask him.
But whatever they're selling, it's important enough for Santoro to have sent the cat.
Three quick questions, and then I'll leave you to get a Band-Aid on your ass. His eyes were wary and jumpy. First, I keep hearing about the American operation. Tell me what you know. Casanova went a shade paler.
You can't know about that.
Clearly, I can. I made a small hand signal and Ghost, right on cue, gave a nice hungry growl. Fat beads of sweat were running down Casanova's cheeks.
I don't know the details. All I know is that it's going to bring America to its knees. It's going to make 9/11 look like a fucking birthday party.
When and where?
I don't know, truly. All I ever heard about is that the staging area is in Texas, near a place called La Borde.
I grunted. I knew a couple of guys who lived there out in East Texas. What about G-55? He shook his head.
I've heard that code, but I don't know what it means. Not my department.
Crap. Okay, let's go back to the meeting with DiCazzi. Tell me everything I need to know. If you trick me, you'd better hope I don't live through it, because I'll let everyone know who put me onto that buy. From the stark terror in his eyes, I knew he believed me. He gave me some details and then said,
"But listen to me, Ledger. You'll need to use a code phrase."
"What phrase?" Casanova said, "It's and then half the fucking building blew up." Chapter 97. Das Wehrarbeitungszentrum, Cell 13. The explosion was so massive it picked up all three of us, Casanova, Ghost, and me, and hurled us across the cell. We hit the wall with crushing force as the deep boom of the blast deafened us. We collapsed down onto the hard floor and lay in a gasping pile, none of us able to move a muscle. Dust plumed from cracks in the walls and ceiling. I heard, as if from miles away, the sharp, high-pitched yelps of Ghost in pain. Everything was muffled and the air was filled with swirling clouds of smoking dust. I rolled sideways, and there was another sharp cry from Ghost. Then I felt him twisting under me, fighting to get free. I fought my way to palms and knees and turned to see the big white dog standing there, a yard away, quivering with pain and confusion.
"Ghost,"
I croaked.
"Report."
This was a command that had taken me a long time and the help of a top dog psychologist and trainer to make him understand. If he was hurt, really hurt, he'd bark twice. A single bark would tell me he was ready to play or fight. He took a moment and then gave a single bark. Not a lot of authority in it, but he emphasized it with a half-hearted wag of his bushy tail.
"That makes one of us,"
I groaned. My body felt like I'd been dropped six stories into a rock quarry. The D-30 composite materials inside my body armor had absorbed a lot of the foot-pounds of impact, but I still hurt a lot, and I'd taken off my helmet to interrogate Casanova. I turned to see how Casanova was doing, and he stared at me and through the wall. He did it from a funny angle, his right ear pressed against one shoulder, and there was a sickening bulge in the side of his neck. The side of his skull had a weird, flattened appearance, and it was clear he'd hit the wall hard enough to crush his skull and break his neck. Ghost and me landing on top of him had ensured that whatever he'd been about to tell me was something Casanova was going to take to the grave. I wanted to hang my head and beat my fists on the floor and yell. This was my last best lead to Santoro. I closed my eyes. I wanted to give up. I wanted to cry. I wanted to die.